You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Joe Sacco has told his investigation into the story of two largely forgotten incidents that happened nearly 54 years ago in comic book form. He's called his latest venture into comic book journalism Footnotes in Gaza, and his early comic series, Palestine, took place in the area, won an American Book Award in 1996. This one is published by Metropolitan Books, and I'm pleased that it brings Mr. Sacco to our show. Hello.
Hi.
And although this takes place in the Gaza Strip, is it fair to say that this isn't a sequel to Palestine, the previous book?
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. I mean, the first book was about, basically took place in the First Intifada, and I was researching this book during the Second Intifada, and there's some of that in there, but generally it's a history. It's a history book.
And the previous one was a journal of what you were experiencing during that time.
Yeah, me bumbling around the West Bank and the Gaza Strip.
So here, what happened here? How did you wind up even knowing about this story?
Well, I was going to the Gaza Strip with another journalist, Chris Hedges.
Not just an unknown. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist.
That's right, and a friend of mine. And we were going to focus on one town, and the town we were going to focus on was Han Yunus. And I recalled something in the back of my head, having read about an incident that took place in Han Yunus in 1956. So I looked it up. And there was a UN document that's referred to that mentions 275 Palestinians being killed. And according to the document, the Israelis say there was resistance to them, and the Palestinians said otherwise. When we got to Han Yunus, we asked about that incident. We heard some stories. Chris wrote it into his article, but that historical episode was cut out of the article. I mean, for whatever reasons.
Oh, you don't know. This is Harper's, which is the kind of magazine that's likely to put that sort of thing in.
Yeah, I mean, it could have been for reasons of space. But for me, I didn't like the idea of cutting that out. I like history, so I wanted to investigate.
But one of the first things that you discovered here, obviously, is that there's disagreement over the circumstances of this incident. And isn't that the case in almost every report we hear about something that has happened in the area?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, in this document, one side said this, one side said that, but there are people alive who experienced it. So my imperative was, well, let's hear what they have to say.
I have to ask you the question that I'm sure Art Spiegelman is tired of hearing, you're tired of hearing. Why tell the story in comic book form?
We're both cartoonists. You know, if I was a documentary filmmaker, perhaps I would have thought of doing it in another way. But I'm a cartoonist. Little by little, I began doing journalism in the comics form. I studied journalism. Organically, those two things came together, journalism and comics. So it just became sort of – it naturally evolved into what it is today for me.
And is there something that is gained by doing it in this form rather than doing it in a film or – in a straight journalistic piece?
I think each medium has its strengths. But what comics does, you know, you open the book and there you are. We like images. People are drawn to images. And you can sort of see a place like a refugee camp in the Gaza Strip immediately. You're pulled into it. And also you can take people back into time sort of seamlessly.
But you can also skew people's perception of what's going on simply by the way you draw a character, whether you make the character look nice or ugly or whatever.
Well, I mean, definitely there's a artistic refraction involved, just as there is for a director who's directing a film about the past.
How do the incidents in Han Yunus and Rafah, the other story that you report on, both in 1956, how do they illustrate the larger Israeli-Palestinian conflict?
Well, I think what they... You know, what's interesting is when I was there, a lot of younger people weren't interested in the history. A lot of Palestinians weren't interested in the history because what was going on now, when I was there, were a lot of home demolitions. And they said, why are you interested in this when you could be focusing on what's going on today? And what it demonstrates to me is that there have been so many events in their history that they're not interested in untangling it themselves. But I think this book sort of demonstrates basically the brutalization of one generation.
So this is before the Israeli withdrawal from Gaza?
At that time, the Egyptians were administering Gaza, and the Israelis kicked out the Egyptians during the Suez Crisis.
No, I meant when you were there and you were talking about the demolition.
Right. When I was there, the Israelis still had settlements there, the army was still there, and Hamas was not in control as it is today.
The situation has changed an awful lot since 1956, and you paired images of the scene in the 50s followed by the same scene in the time you were there. Would you have to do a third version if you went there today?
Well, perhaps I would have to do a third version. I mean, there have been some surprising changes in Gaza.
How much has changed? The first time you were there was in the 1990s, and then you returned 2002, 2003.
I'd say there were two changes. One was that the level of violence was much greater. In the first intifada, we're talking about bullets and stones. In the second intifada, we're talking about suicide bombings and military aircraft attacking. I mean, the plateau had gone up. And also the refugee camps had changed quite a bit. There'd been a lot of building, probably around the time when there was the Oslo period, when people thought perhaps it's going to be peace, it's time to build.
Now, these are both of these incidents are described as Israeli atrocities against Palestinians. You could have just as easily have done a book about Palestinian atrocities against Israelis.
Yes, I could have done
buses
a book about
buses being blown up by suicide bombers and the like.
Right, which
missiles.
I do.
Missiles.
Yes, and I do mention the suicide bombings in the book and the Palestinian reaction to the suicide bombings in the book. I mean, yes, you're right. I could have gone at certain looked at other things. I feel like Palestinian history isn't particularly well known, not just by Palestinians sometimes, but definitely by the West.
So what happened in these two incidents? You devote more attention to Rafah. Why Rafah rather than Khan Yunis, which is what got you interested in this in the first place?
Basically because Khan Yunis, it was a bigger event, but it was very straightforward. From what the men told me, the Palestinian men who survived it, Israeli forces took men out of their homes and shot them if they were of military age. In Rafah, there was a screening episode. It seemed a little less clear what happened. There were many more people who were involved in it. You could basically go up to any man who was over the age of 65, and he was involved in this screening operation because the Israelis called all men ages 15 or so above to gather at a school.
And what was their reason for doing this?
They were trying to find Fedayeen guerrillas who had been attacking Israel in the period prior, and also Palestinian soldiers who'd taken off their uniforms, who'd been in the Egyptian army.
This is a kind of embedded journalism, isn't it?
Yes, I would say so.
Because you lived there while you were researching the story. You become friends with some of the people involved. How difficult is it to uncover the facts as a journalist would describe them as real facts?
Well, I do talk about there are problems with memory and things like that, and I do get into that. I do show sort of the seams in the story, the bumps in the story, and some discrepancies. But I think what the reader, I think, comes away with is the essential arc of the story.
In Rafah, weren't you told by your Palestinian guides not to take an apartment in the center of the refugee camp?
That's right. I mean, that was partly, they thought, perhaps for my own safety, and also because the center of the camp was an area of resistance.
Well, what is an apartment in a refugee camp like?
Well, my apartment was basically a palace. It was a place where an individual was working in the Gulf States, sending money home for his retirement, a place to come back to retire to, and his brother opened it up for me. I mean, they basically wanted me to be comfortable.
Well, why are there still refugee camps 62 years after the creation of the State of Israel? Can people still look upon themselves as refugees so many years later? Because I'm assuming most of the people living there were born there.
Yes, but they still know about the town they were from in Israel, and they still talk about it.
And they don't see this as just as a new town?
Well, I mean, some of them do, and some of them would have put down roots and would stay if there was a comprehensive peace settlement. Others might have a different opinion. It depends on the individual.
How do the Gazans you met generally feel about America and the Western world? Did it help that you weren't born in the United States?
To some extent, that helped, but they knew that I was from America and came from America, but they treated me as an individual. And they didn't, you know, they saw me as an individual separate from the government.
And you were getting your stories through translation, weren't you?
That's correct.
You generally, were with a guy named Abed.
Yes. Some people spoke English to me, but generally it was translated.
One of the Israeli novelists, prominent Israeli novelist David Grossman, who has many friends who are Palestinian, says that when they talk, when they get together, they speak in English because that gives neither of them an edge.
That's interesting.
Because he can speak Arabic and the Palestinians can speak Hebrew, and yet English becomes the neutral language.
Oh, that's interesting.
How many people did you meet who actually spoke English?
I'd say perhaps of the older people, perhaps one in every 15 or so, something like that.
Since your drawings are a form of journalism, did you base your drawings, were you drawing while you were talking, or did you take photographs, or is much of this based on memory?
I take a lot of photographs for reference, and for older periods, like what the camps looked like in the 50s, I went to the UNRWA, the UN archives in Gaza City, and they actually gave me photographs.
Because otherwise you're really drawing from people's memories, aren't you?
That's right. I mean, I did have to ask them to describe things to me, but I asked many people to describe things to me. And I've trained myself to ask what I call visual questions.
And you also include yourself in the drawings.
Yeah, that's right.
As a way of not taking a bird's eye view of making yourself part of the story?
Well, I came out of the autobiographical tradition of cartoonists, and organically I just began showing myself in the stories. But I think what it symbolizes is that on some level, this is a subjective viewpoint. You're seeing things through my eyes, but it allows me to introduce the reader to people and get those interrelationships with people across.
Chris Hedges has also been in the former Yugoslavia, and he's written about the adrenaline rush of being in crisis situations. One of your books took place in Bosnia, a place where I think there still are unresolved problems, kind of similar to what's going on in Israel and Palestine.
Yeah, that's right.
So are you drawn to those kinds of conflicts?
I think I'm drawn to conflicts that involve civilians. I'm interested in civilians and how they respond to conflict. I think perhaps because my parents, during World War II, lived in Malta and they were bombed by both the Germans and the Italians. And I grew up with those stories. And so how people are pushed around by historical events interests me.
Do you see, as an outsider, do you see any possibility that these issues can be resolved?
Politically speaking, I'm probably more pessimistic than I've ever been.
There's a movie that is the Israeli entry into the Academy Awards this year called Ajami. I don't know if you've seen it.
I haven't.
But it's made in collaboration between an Arab Israeli and a Jewish Israeli. And basically the message of it is that no matter how good your intentions are, you're going to be trapped to some degree by the circumstances of this ongoing conflict.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I do know that individuals can relate to each other. I heard many old people, old Palestinians, talk about the days when they had businesses with their Israelis and when Israelis would come to their weddings and things like that. You know that on a personal level, if there was maybe a generation, a buffer, we'd probably get along again on some level. There can always be a reason why it can restart. There's always the kindling there, it seems.
Some people have suggested that a peace agreement be arrived at with the understanding that for 5 to 10 years or so, there are going to be an awful lot of attempts to sabotage it. And then in time, as things become normal, we may actually see peace. But it's very hard to get to.
Yeah, I have no answers, I think, Leonard.
Joe Sacco's latest book, his follow-up to Palestine and Safe Area Garaja, is Footnotes in Gaza. It's gotten fabulous reviews. It's published by Metropolitan Books, and I want to thank you so much for being with us today.
It was a pleasure, Leonard.